Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you play around the world today, but you started with a fairly humble goal of bringing better music to political events. How did that lead to starting Pink Martini?
So after graduating from college in 1992, I moved back to Portland, Oregon, with the intention of going into politics. I really wanted to become mayor of Portland. So I was working on various campaigns. And in 1994, there was a nasty attempt to amend the Oregon Constitution to declare homosexuality illegal, along with bestiality, pedophilia, and necrophilia, the four that are always seem to be linked. And I had just seen Pee Wee Herman's Christmas special. And I don't know if you've ever seen this Christmas special, but in 45 minutes, he's packed all kinds of guest stars into one 45-minute Christmas special. So everybody from Grace Jones to Katie Lang, Charo, Frankie Avalon, Annette Funicello, Zsa Zsa Gabor, Dinah Shore, Oprah Winfrey, Whoopi Goldberg, Magic Johnson, Little Richard, and the Del Rubio triplets, three gals, three guitars, somewhere between the ages of 70 and 80, who wore miniskirts, little booties, had huge hair, looked exactly like were literally triplets from Panama, and they played the guitar and warbled covers of Walk Like an Egyptian and Whip It. And
I have heard them, actually.
They're incredible. And so I decided to bring them to Portland to do a series of small concerts in nursing homes, retirement homes, hospitals, and rotary meetings. And then they would say at the end of the set, please vote no on Measure 13. And at the end of the week, we had a big community-wide concert at Cinema 21 in Portland, and I couldn't get a hold of the surf band that I wanted to open for the Del Rubios, so I threw in a cocktail dress and started Pink Martini. That's how we began. And it was such a hit at the time that we really became the kind of the house band for progressive causes. So we did benefits for cleaning up the Willamette River, for example, or affordable housing, or civil rights, or public libraries, public broadcasting, and that's how we spent our first several 3 years.
Well, and you say that if the United Nations had a house band in 1962, hopefully Pink Martini would be it. What does that mean to you, and why 1962?
Well, I think you know, the music that the band plays from the beginning, and certainly with the release of our first album, the idea is that it's sort of somewhere nestled between Breakfast at Tiffany's, the soundtrack to Breakfast at Tiffany's, those party sequences, coupled with this kind of old-fashioned global symphonic pop. So there are songs in 20, 25 different languages, and it all has this sort of aesthetic that is kind of somewhere between a Hollywood musical and if you're to cross a Hollywood musical of the 40s and 50s with the United Nations, that's kind of hopefully what that I think describes the band. So there are sort of songs in Portuguese and French and Arabic and Greek and Turkish, and it all has this sort of aesthetic of a pre-1962 aesthetic, which to me means that it has sort of grace and style and space and beauty. That's sort of, I mean, it's old fashioned, really. We're going the opposite direction of American pop culture, and but modern in the sense that we're entirely inclusive and put these sort of disparate pieces together to create sort of a new thing.
So as you said, Pink Martini takes music from around the globe, often singing in the original language, I think 10 languages on the new album alone. Do you ever worry about where the line is between appreciation and appropriation?
Yeah. I mean, I think that we cite our sources always. And we when we're working on a song in a different language, we've got a series of professors, language professors and history professors who sort of help guide us through the cultural meaning as well as the pronunciation so that we're hopefully not butchering the language. You know, I mean, that question is interesting because, you know, I think that we're respectful of the traditions and respectful of the past and respectful of the history, and yet because America is really the most heterogeneously populated country in the world, comprised of people from every language, every country, every religion, that in a sense it is a real sort of American band in a true sense. And I think the fact that we're singing songs in all of these different languages and trying to be respectful, that earnest goal keeps it from becoming offensive.
So let's talk about China Forbes' voice. All I can say is, wow, she just always wows me. And while the power of it is incredible, she can also be very gentle and even vulnerable. How key has China been to Pink Martini and the music you've been able to tackle because of her voice?
Well, we have two singers now. China had a vocal surgery on her vocal cords about 6 years ago. And another singer named Storm Large, who also lives in Portland, is based in Portland, came to our rescue. And so the two of them, Storm Large and China Forbes, they divide the time. China sings maybe two-thirds of the time, and Storm sings about a third of the time. And it's great, actually, having two singers. And China sounds sort of better than ever, I think, these mm-hmm. days. Like, after the surgery, she really buckled down and started studying, again, with her vocal coach, and sounds totally magnificent. I think that her voice is very much a part of the success of the band, because it's a neighborly voice. It soars, yet you can sing along with China in the shower. And so it's not like a soprano voice, which I think is more unreal. It's lower, and in that sense, it's rewarding. And so I think it feels very familiar and neighborly to people who are listening.
You talked about the political origins of Pink Martini, and you've written songs about social and political issues like strikes in Paris in this familiar cut.
Je ne veux pas travailler, je ne veux pas déjeuner, je veux seulement oublier, et puis je fume.
So politics have always been part of your mandate. In a way, do you still see yourself as having a political mission today?
Well, I think the challenge right now, this is our 23rd year. We started in 1994. And so that's nearly a quarter of a century of seeing different things happen. I think that right now what is required really of the band is a certain kind of diplomacy and an encouragement of critical discussion of sort of current issues. I think that there's so little of that currently now. There's just a lot of sort of screaming and shouting, and that has, I think, to do with sort of the way the culture communicates. We now have sort of social media and texting and cell phones, which just weren't a part of the world when we started 23 years ago. Also, sort of television and film, I think increasingly there's been sort of more screaming and less listening as the years have passed. So I think that because our audience is really, it's a very diverse, wildly diverse audience. There are very conservative people as well as very liberal people, everybody in between. There are people of different ages, people from different cultures. And so it's one of the few places, I think, in modern America where there's such a diverse crowd of people under one rooftop, and the idea is that by the end of it, everybody is part of a conga line. So I think that rather than I mean, I certainly have a lot of opinions, political opinions about what's going on, and that may become more and more dire as the days pass. But at this moment, I feel like the best thing that Pink Martini can do is really be a binding force that kind of gathers people together and encourages them to maybe break down sort of assumptions that they might have, and find ways to actually have difficult conversations.
We're talking with Thomas Lauderdale. He's founder and pianist for the band Pink Martini. They'll be performing in Wisconsin this week, in Milwaukee on Tuesday night at the Pabst Theater, and in Madison on Wednesday night at the Overture Center. Thomas, you do a lot of original music in Pink Martini, but you also do a lot of covers. Is it ever scary to do a new rendition of a well-known and well-loved song?
It depends. It depends on the song. Like, many of the songs that we cover are songs that are popular in the country of the language.
Mm-hmm.
So while in the Arab world everybody may know a song by Feruz, outside of the Arab world, in the United States or in almost any other in Hong Kong or Japan, they're not going to have really heard of Feruz. So in a sense, we're bringing the music of Feruz to the attention of an audience that has never – that doesn't know who Feruz is.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of like an American – a song in English, I feel like unless there's something really new to contribute to that song, it doesn't really make sense to necessarily cover it. With the first album, for example, the song Que Sera Sera is mm-hmm. a very sort of slow, kind of dark, Bernard Herrmann-esque kind of version of that song. Because I always felt that the version that Doris Day sang in the original film, Man Who Knew Too Much, was much too cheerful and chipper considering the dark circumstances. So our version of Que Sera Sera became more dark and epic and almost like an underwater Leni Riefenstahl-esque kind of adventure.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Here's what she said to me.
So yeah, I mean, if there's something sort of a new presentation or a new way to think of a song, then I think it's good. For example, I don't think that we would ever cover the song "La Vie en Rose" by Edith Piaf, because I can't imagine how one would do that in really a different, unusual, fantastic mm-hmm. way.
Is there a song you haven't covered yet, but you would love to?
Not that I can. Not that I think of.
Well, we'll watch for the next album and see what you come up with. So you collaborate with artists from around the world. Which of those collaborations really stands out as particularly memorable for you?
I think, you know, from the beginning, there was this realization that there was an opportunity to work with people sort of who were my heroes or who I grew up loving. For example, Phyllis Diller. Several years ago when we were in Los Angeles, I knew that my friend Kim Hostreiter, who is the editor-in-chief of Paper Magazine in New York City, who also plays the triangle and crash cymbals and glockenspiel with us occasionally, we were all playing together down in Los Angeles for New Year's Eve. And I knew that she was friends with Phyllis Diller, so I begged her to take me to Phyllis Diller's house. And Phyllis Diller, although she wasn't feeling necessarily the best that particular night, made us chili. And walking through her house, there were hundreds of paintings on the wall, each by Phyllis Diller, and each with a price tag. And you would take the paintings off the wall that you really wanted, and then you'd be tallied up. You'd write a check, and then she'd sign them, and then off you'd go. And so I did that. I came home with a whole suitcase. I had to buy another suitcase to get the Phyllis Diller paintings home. And at the end of that sort of meeting, I suddenly thought I should ask her if she would consider recording a song with us, knowing that she had made albums in the 60s and also that she was a pianist and had studied piano growing up in Ohio. And so we asked her, and she amazingly said yes. So about a month later, we went down with our recording engineer to who's actually from Wisconsin, actually, Dave Friedlander, and we went and set up an impromptu recording studio in Phyllis Diller's living room, and she recorded the song Smile by Charlie Chaplin, who was a friend of hers, and it ended up being her last recording. So something like that, to have Phyllis Diller at age 95 recording the song Smile by Charlie Chaplin, a friend of hers, is extraordinary. Similarly, we've worked with all kinds of people, everybody from Jane Powell, the MGM movie star who grew up in Portland, Oregon, and was the War Bonds girl during World War II in Portland, to Carol Channing, to Hiroshi Wada, who for 50 years had a group called Hiroshi Wada and his Mahina Stars in Japan, to Saori Yuki, the Barbra Streisand of Japan, who began her career in 1969, to George Moustaki, who wrote songs for who wrote Milor for Edith Piaf towards the end of her life. So, you know, working with these people, and the youngest, I guess, would be certainly the Von Trapps, the great grandchildren of
them up, yeah,
the great grandchildren of Maria and Georg Von Trapp of the Sound of Music fame, who altogether probably add up to less at the time added up to less than 80 years old.
Right, right, and so you really kind of gave them a springboard and a much larger audience. These four grandchildren in the Von Trapp family.
Great grandchildren.
Great grandchildren.
Well, you know, I think they had a huge career sort of by themselves growing up as the Von Trapp children. And so I think August was maybe seven. He was the youngest at the time. And Sophie was maybe 11 or 12 when they started. They had a decade-long career kind of traveling around as the Von Trapp great grandchildren. And I met them and they were sort of trying to transition from singing folk songs and the Sound of Music songs to something else, and they wanted to broaden. And so I had a bunch of ideas, and so they were living in Texas at the time, though they had been raised in Montana, and I convinced them to move to Portland, and we worked on an album which came out several years ago, and then they proceeded to release a couple of other LPs, and now are taking a break. But it was they're extraordinary. They are really unlike most people of their generation. They're very, I mean, they're now in their 20s, mm-hmm. and they have sort of this incredible old world respect for the past, are deep in thought, and I mean, they're just extraordinary people, not distracted by their cell phones and texting and tweeting and all of that.
Well, let's take a listen to someone whose speaking voice will be very familiar to our listeners.
Matin sanish Anna in ilek fiso al Bardon tafe Wahesh ni modara Fis nim sabart Lohobira Umri ra Hwaya Fil wahdadi.
That's NPR's Ari Shapiro, and I have to say he has a lovely voice. How did he end up singing with Pink Martini?
So, you know, Ari Shapiro is from Portland, Oregon, actually. And when we were in the midst of working on our second album, he came to Oregon to do one of his first stories, which was, why hasn't Pink Martini released a second album? And so we became friends, and then in the years sort of following, whenever we came to D.C., he would throw us sort of a welcome. He would pull out the welcome wagon and throw parties for the band. And maybe in 2008, I think it was, we were working on our fourth album, Splendor in the Grass. And Ari threw a barbecue for us, as well as the band Blind Pilot, that's Portland-based, that was in town. And there was a sing-along upstairs around Ari's piano, and I was reminded what a great voice Ari had. And so the following day, I called up and I asked him if he would consider recording a song, and that was for the fourth album, and he's been singing with us ever since.
So anyone who has seen Pink Martini perform, Thomas, would be pretty sure that you all are having a really good time up there. Are you?
Yes, for the most part. I mean, obviously there are days that are maybe a little bit off, but I would say that, you know, because the band is relatively large, there are anywhere between 8 and 12 people on stage at any given time, that that because the band is so large and the material is diverse and the audiences are diverse, that there's always sort of something to hold on to that's very fun. You know, lately in recent years, we've had sort of dance moments where hopefully everybody kind of floods the stage and comes on stage and dances. There are conga lines, hopefully, at the end of every night. And so people leave feeling uplifted and hopeful, which I think is really important, especially in these sort of times, which are somewhat bleak.
You clearly work hard on stage and in the studio. Thomas, what do you listen to in your own downtime?
Lately I've been listening to I've been listening to a lot of Schubert. I'm working on the Fantasy in F minor for four hands, one piano with my partner Hunter. I've discovered the French soundtrack to Jesus Christ Superstar. I've also been listening to Duke Ellington's album, which are Mary Poppins, which is sort of his take, Duke Ellington's sort of arrangements of all the songs from Mary Poppins that was recorded in the mid-60s. That's a great album. And then, of course, there are just sort of like the mixed compilations that I make every so often, which have everything from songs of Gougouche from Iran to Miriam Makeba from South Africa.
Well, Thomas, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much.